previously.tvpodcastnetwork.
911. I have someone here that I need to be arrested in my home.
They're there right now?
I have a possible missing child. I have a 3-year-old that's been missing for a month.
A 3-year-old?
Yes.
Have you reported that?
I'm trying to do that now, ma'am. I'd like to speak to an officer. Can you have someone come out to my house?
Okay. I got to ask you these questions so I can put them in the call, okay?
Okay.
Okay, what's your name?
Casey Anthony.
Casey Anthony's trial gets the real crime profile treatment in the case of Kaylee Anthony. The death of Cindy Ray gets the bat mitzvah video treatment in Confessions of Crime. And we get the Crime Writers On treatment again, some more, with the only woman who has more podcasts than I do, Rebecca Lavoie. This is The Blotter Presents, episode 56. Welcome back to The Blotter Presents. This is Previously.tv's take on all things TV true crime, and I am thrilled to be joined at last by Crime Writers On's Rebecca Lavoie. Hello, Rebecca.
Hello, Sarah. I can't believe I'm here either. This is very exciting for me.
I think that Rebecca had to physically remove Toby Ball from the guest chair.
Had to pry him out.
I did not realize until doing a little searching around previously.tv that Toby's first appearance was about the investigation discovery take on Kaylee and Casey Anthony.
Was it now?
So it's all a circle of trash.
It is. It's a circle of trash, but that trash was not, I don't think, stored in a trunk for several months. I don't think that was the cause of that odor. Just my take on that. But yes, it's exactly right. And it might feel circular to you also, because I'm not sure there's anything that we saw in this show that wasn't also in that investigation discovery show. Maybe.
Well, we will get into that on our most wanted section. But first, and to my delight, the clip that I've been waiting to play since I met my husband over 6 years ago. Update. That's right, listeners of episode 55, my husband Dan Patrick Brady's Unsolved Mysteries has been located. Thank you so much to Beth, who did in 6 hours what I had been trying to do for 6 years, which is find young Dan in a 1989 episode of Unsolved Mysteries. Folks, you can watch it yourselves on Amazon Prime. It is season 2, episode 16, and here's a little clip which verified for me that it was definitely the man in question.
As Brown pulled away in his truck, police closed in.
Out of the car! Hands in the roof! Move faster! Come on! Beat back! Way back!
He told us that the acetone belonged to another subject.
If I had a nickel for every time Dan asked me, where's the acetone, or told me to put my hands on the roof. But yeah, it's definitely him, little late 80s mullet and Amber Vision sunglasses. Yeah, that's our boy. So again, thank you to everyone who combed through some of these really brutal reenactments in search of my husband. And now we can finally put that case to rest. I don't think we're ever going to be rid of the case in our most wanted section. Okay, so here we go again with the case of Kaylee Anthony. This is, I guess, an extension of a franchise that started on CBS with the case of JonBenet Ramsey. Mm-hmm. But featuring the same investigative team. In case anyone has been deep in the heart of Amish country for the last decade, let me give you the case file. On July 15th, 2008, toddler Kaylee Anthony was reported missing by her grandmother, Cindy, who said she had not seen Kaylee for 31 days and that Kaylee's mother, Casey's car, smelled like a dead body had been inside it. Cindy said Casey had given varied explanations as to Kaylee's whereabouts, and Casey lied to detectives, telling them Kaylee had been kidnapped by a nanny on June 9th, and that she, Casey, had been trying to find Kaylee, too frightened to alert the authorities. 4 months later, Kaylee's body was found in a wooded area near the Anthony home. Casey was found not guilty of first-degree murder and various child endangerment charges in her 2011 trial, but what exactly happened to Kaylee and why has bugged the world ever since. Now, real crime profilers Jim Clemente and Laura Richard are back to tackle yet another child murder in Oxygen's three-part series. Listeners, as you hear this, the series will have concluded. We had a screener for the first hour of the first part. I watched part two today while doing desk work. Rebecca, did you get any further into it than the screener that we had or no?
No, I just watched part one. Are you certain it was only an hour? I mean, that's a real question. It felt longer to me.
It did. Those extremely self-important shots of Jim and Laura driving with the camera 3 inches away from their temples did sort of drag out.
They take this investigation very seriously.
Yes, they
do. It's a real investigation into one of America's greatest unsolved cases in which everybody knows exactly what it is that happened. Right?
What do you think happened?
I mean, I guess I just don't understand why this is being couched as if there is a lot of questions about it. Because I think the biggest question for me has always been, you know, why didn't the state tell a better story at the trial and convict this woman who, to me, pretty clearly, probably, allegedly, I mean, she was identified as a suspect, so I really can't libel her. I mean, I think she did it. And I just can't imagine that we are doing this roundtable investigation. It's not really an investigation. Who are we kidding? And that we're pretending that we're starting from scratch here. That to me is the most like amazing part of the conceit of the setup of this whole thing.
Let's listen to clip three in which Jim Clemente is obliged and manages not to sound impatient while doing it, which is which he's improved on since the last The Case of installment. Manages to not sound too over it and eye-rolly while explaining what it is that they're trying to do. For the TV audience that doesn't marinate in this sort of topic daily, here's clip three.
Really, two levels of inquiry. One level of inquiry is about what happened to Kaylee, who was involved in what happened to her, and how she ended up in that swampy area. And the other level is what really was going on in that family. Also, the question hangs out there, did somebody kill her or did she die accidentally? We just have to keep digging to find out.
Well, you know, I think that as a, you know, content creator, this is, you know, this is true crime fan nip, this kind of case, because everybody is 95% sure that they know, but you're never really going to know. And there's always that hope that finally somebody's going to be like, oh no, this is what happened.
This is the thing. This is tough because we're talking about like a dead toddler, right? So I don't want to sound callous. So can we just pretend that we're not talking about a dead toddler and I'll just say what I'm going to say and like the callous part out of it? Why do we think about this case so much? Because this to me is not one of those ones where it's like a world of possibility, so much so that you could be driving around in a car together and earnestly talking about it with your years of combined profiling experience. What's a whole other topic that we should talk about at some point.
Oh, we will. Twitter wars, chapter one.
Exactly. But the JonBenet Ramsey case, now that show was terrible and super flawed and libelous in about 100 different levels. To me, that case actually has a mystery at its heart of it. Like there's just so many things about it that just seemed like zigs and zags in terms of you know, the notes, the, you know, the parents, the kids, the family, the business stuff, all the different angles. This is so much more straightforward. It's like a family. It's like a domestic is kind of what it is. It's, that's how it feels. And if it were an adult who had died, it would be couched that way. But because it was a child who died and because the mother was attractive and because there was this very high profile trial, I guess it's still seen as a mystery or something we're supposed to be like hanging on. I just don't understand even why the hardcore true crime catnip fans like would be into this, especially given that Investigation Discovery just did this and did it like almost identically, like pretty recently.
I mean, my sense of it is that the thing that these cases share is not just that we're never really going to know what happened, probably. I mean, there's an outside shot that somebody will come forward having had sodium pentothal and be like, no, let me explain to you a few things.
But you mean Casey Anthony will come forward and tell you what she did?
Yeah, it could happen. I mean, we'll get back to why I think that won't happen in a second. But I think that at the heart of this is the judging of parents and specifically of mothers and how a parent and specifically a mom, quote, should be in a situation in which their child has come to harm.
Right.
And if you're not.
And how a woman should be.
Yes.
Right.
And if you're not, if your acting is not up to snuff, like this is really about, I think, American culture wanting to find Casey Anthony guilty of being a trashy asshole.
Right.
And trying to find some kind of felony around which to arrange that problem. Mm.
Right.
So I
don't disagree. And this is why I think she sort of gives like this whole sexist narrative a bad name, because you're not wrong. Like the vilification of women and mothers in these crimes is sexist bullshit that, you know, has led to like a lot of bad outcomes in terms of like criminal justice and wrongful convictions and just, you know, people's lives and like people who are legitimately suffering from mental illness, which I will talk about later in the show. We talk about the other show we watched.
Ooh, yeah.
but this is the thing, though, is that in my opinion, Casey Anthony is kind of like, she unfortunately really seems to be living out that stereotype on like four different levels. I mean, she does have a strange affect. She is a documented, admitted liar. She, you know, yes, there's a way you're supposed to feel according to the society when something's happened to your kid. But then there's the opposite of that. And she definitely lives the extreme. Let's put it that way. And so I have a really hard time. I mean, I want to make all the same feminist arguments I always make around these stories, but it's hard for me with her, not because I hold her any more responsible for killing her own kid than I would hold anybody who did that. But like, she's
hard entitled to the presumption of innocence and she's entitled to the, to, you know, nestle under or like behind the aegis of
acquittal,
you know, no, well, doesn't matter if she's entitled to that or not. That's what she got.
Right.
But she's entitled to our, you know, feminist protections.
Sure.
Even if she did something, which I just keep coming back to John Douglas talking about, Hauptmann and the Lindbergh case. And he's like, well, he didn't do everything, but he fucking did something. Like, yeah, she did something. And then she did nothing. Like there's so what this, show does do well for me. I'm sort of familiar with like the headlines and the sub headlines of the case, but not the nitty gritty of it. Like I was not invested in this to this extent, but it does remind you of just how much straight up hinky shit was going on with this investigation from the jump. Here's clip four.
Hey, what's her name?
Casey Anthony.
Casey's there right now?
Yes, I got her. I finally found her after a month. She's been missing for a month. I found her, but we can't find my granddaughter.
Is Casey not telling you where her daughter is?
Correct.
Okay, we'll have a deputy out to you as soon as one's available, okay?
Thank you.
Thank you.
I mean, Cindy's tone in this call, which I believe was the second of three calls, the third one,
which is fascinating.
Yeah, everybody's heard a gazillion times, and that's the one where she's freaking out because she smelled whatever had been in the trunk.
Dead body? You can say it. It's a dead body.
Yeah, it was a dead body. A tiny dead body. Which at least we didn't have to see a reenactment involving a flashlight and a skull with a wig on it this time.
Yeah.
Although who knows what happens in part three. Exactly. I mean, I thought more highly of the previous installation of this than you, which how hard is that really? But that was grim. That poor kid.
That was the worst.
Yeah.
It was one of the worst things I've ever seen on television in terms of like responsibility. was so bad. It was so bad.
I could not even believe. And like, I was trying to cut a photo to put on our coverage of the site. And it's like, how do I indicate how creepy this is without actually showing the whole thing? Cause I don't want to trigger myself because it was really gross. But yeah, here's another fact from this, that's sort of like pursuant to this 911 call. Casey stole her parents' car or took it without permission and then just kept it and then abandoned it.
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah. That's why I say this is a domestic, it's a domestic situation. I mean, if it weren't for the dead kid or if there were anybody dead other than a little kid, like I said, because what I hear in these three succession of calls, especially I think the first one is the most interesting, which is in the car with her and she's trying to like drive her to a police station.
Yeah. And in the background, you can hear Casey being like, Mom.
Exactly.
Like, oh,
she's just
girl.
She's a mother of a stunted adult child. And she's at her wit's end. Right. She's like, I know what we're going to do. We're going to take you to the cops. And it's almost like she's doing that thing that it's like that tough love thing.
Straighten up and fly.
Exactly.
Right.
But given what we know about Casey's behavior after she talks to the cops, when she's willing to like go all the way to the point where she has to acknowledge that she's lying, that Universal Studios story, you know, where she has to like take them to literally the end of the hallway. And then she's like, okay, I'm lying. Like, I think that's what she's doing to her mom in this situation. I think her mom is like, well, I'm going to take you to the cops. And she's like, okay, fine, let's go to the cops. And then they're on their way to the cops and the mom is like calling. And, you know, I think at this point, Casey probably hasn't yet told the lie about where the kid is. And so the mom doesn't know that yet. And you can tell with the spacing of these calls that Casey is like revealing more information in between each of them, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But then never exactly revealing. Well, let's jump ahead actually to clip six, where we hear part of the interrogation. And then one of the original detectives from the case, who was the one who was like taken to this dead end hallway and was like, what are we doing here? he's talking in the beginning of this clip.
We walk into the building and we're kind of making small talk. She's telling me that someday she'd like to be a personal trainer. And we turn down a dead end hall and there's really no place else to walk. And at that point, she turns and looks at us and says, I don't really work here. And so we sat down and interviewed her.
I'm absolutely petrified. Absolutely petrified. I know my mom will never forgive me. I'm never going to forgive myself. Because there's that chance that I might not see Kaylee again. And I don't want to think about
that. Let me ask you, by lying to us and sending us all these wild goose chases, hold on a minute, okay? I want you to tell me, is it that there's some other thing more important in your life right now? Like, or did you purposely mislead us? Which of those two is it? Okay, so you purposely misled us. This was all an attempt to help find your daughter, right? That makes sense to you, correct?
In a backward sort of way, yes.
I'm
coming back to places that are familiar to me that I know are familiar to her.
How old is she?
Would help. She's almost three.
She's almost three. What do you think she's going to take a cab here?
I mean,
I love
okay.
That guy.
I know. MVP, that guy. But also, like, so we're just chit-chatting about how she wants to become a personal trainer. Like, of course she does, Florida. Mm-hmm. And, but then I don't really understand what's going on in that interrogation from the law enforcement side. Do you? Like, I don't understand what he's trying to get her to say.
I think He's trying to get her to say, this is why I've been lying to you. Because
okay,
I think a typical, if you ever watch The First 48, which I do.
Yes, same. And I am always struck by how eventually it's like the fourth question in, they finally okay. like, fuck it. Yeah. Like, yeah, I killed his ass. Like, oh.
Yeah. Or like, I know. Okay. I know who did. It was Tony.
It's always Tony.
So I think that's what he thinks is going to happen. I think if you catch somebody in a lie, the typical reaction when they're caught in the lie is like, first they lie again, and then maybe they lie a third time, and then they realize like, it's not going anywhere. They'll be like, all right. And then it's like they give the reason why they lied. They say, I lied because I was afraid of getting in trouble, or I lied because I didn't want to go to jail, or I lied. But he's just trying to get her there, and she won't go there. Like, she won't even say why it is she's lying. And then she's that weird thing about, like, I'm afraid my mother, I know my mother will never forgive me.
Yeah.
That says, I mean, that speaks to the situation we heard about before, right? Where the mother is the one who's always like, Jesus Christ, Casey, just like, get your shit together. You know, you can tell this mother is just completely fed up.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you think about why, like, kids lie, kids, little kids lie because they're afraid of getting caught and because they're afraid of what will happen if they get caught. Like, that's what this feels like, except the stakes are so much higher that it just seems so absurd. But I think he thinks she's going to do what everyone does in the first 48. And in the fourth question, just be like, all right, I killed my daughter. Let me tell you what happened.
Yeah.
That's what I think he's trying to get to.
Which, I mean, if my understanding of what probably happened is correct, which is like, she didn't drown in the pool, but something happened to her because she was not being supervised.
I think what happened is Casey had probably given her something to make her sleep and be quiet, and maybe even like put her in the car or something while she was doing something else. Something happened
Good
to her
theory.
Because she was unsupervised. But I think that, can we talk about the chloroform, or is that jumping ahead too much?
Oh, no. But okay. Let's put a pin in that for right now.
Okay.
Because we do have a clip for that. But I wanted to mention that in part two, there's this interview with a member of Casey's defense team in which he talks about what he calls Casey World.
Mm.
And that, you know, Clemenia is like, so in your sense of what actually happened? And he's like, all right, the thing is that any attempt to confront her with the reality of what she may have done, like the way he says that he has basically chosen to believe the pool story, but what he's actually saying subtext wise is like, it's, you know, it's the only story that makes any sense that we've ever heard. Mm. So we're just going to go with that one. And it worked, but he refers to Casey World and basically says that she just dissociating at the idea of Kaylee being dead and couldn't, like, would not interface with that reality. So I think
that's
maybe
giving her a lot of credit. I really do. I don't know. The dissociating narrative, I've heard that around her before.
I'm not saying I believe it. I'm saying this is what the attorney is retailing. I think that there is perhaps some kind of, not delay, but something about her that, I mean, my grandmother used to use not quite right as a catch-all.
Yeah, no, I agree. Yeah.
For everything from, you know, spectrum stuff, delays, traumatic brain injury, jerk, like that, not
so
quite
as they,
right
as they
was everything.
Say on Teen Mom, you think she's slow? Mm-hmm. I think that there is some of that, but I also think she is stunted. I think she's like a child, but she's also like a sociopathic child.
Yeah.
You know, she doesn't seem to, I mean, really, and again, all my feminist tackles raise when I like talk about this, because I think the word sociopath is thrown around way too often. And I also think, you know, women who have dead kids are characterized this way way too often. But this is what I think in this case. I think it's very difficult for her to grasp when she's doing something that there could be a consequence. I think in the moment she decides it doesn't matter, I think she rolls with it. And I think when the consequence happens, she just thinks it shouldn't apply to her, or somehow doesn't, and doesn't really have the same feelings about it that other people would. I mean, she seems really off to me. You're not wrong on that.
Well, yeah. I mean, this is why I think maybe there is some kind of delay. I mean, like literally a developmental delay where she's still, you know, that concept of the magic age where kids are like 7 or 8 and all of a sudden they stop being completely like center focused sociopaths, for lack of a better term, and start understanding where they operate in, you know, with respect to the world and other people.
Yep.
This did not occur with her at any time, I guess. And I mean, that would qualify as a developmental delay. It's just like an emotional developmental delay, I guess. And you have to wonder what that family was like and I don't know.
Yeah, that's the thing. So I want to know more about, and I think that actually speaks to this thing. She didn't graduate high school, right? So I want to know about that.
Yeah.
And if she is one of these people who like uses charm to get through, charm in the moment. Like we all know there comes a point in your algebra class where that just stops working, like because you actually have to have like passed the test.
Yeah.
And you have to wonder like if that's what happened. Did she just... was she never able to make the connection that she just can't will it into being that a teacher would pass her? And then is that, and it caught up with her? I don't know.
Well, and then the entire matter of her pregnancy, which I think she was like just going the baggy sweatshirts route until it would be too late for her parents to tell her that she couldn't do it.
And then they wanted to keep it private, which is seen as suspicious in this show for some reason. I mean, my thought when I saw that is I bet they were trying to talk her into giving baby up for adoption or something. Maybe.
Right.
Or maybe they, you know, I don't think there's anything nefarious in the parents of a 19-year-old not openly talking about their kid being pregnant, especially if they don't know what the outcome of that pregnancy is going to be.
Well, and also that I think Cindy is probably pretty well aware of, you know, what's going on with Casey. And was probably like, the fewer people who know that this child might have been born, the fewer who can tattle on us when we leave it at a fire station. Like, I mean, because if I'm responsible for Casey and this is the situation, I'm like, so here's the thing. Find a nice looking church steps and... Let's not, because it's not going to end well. And it didn't.
It's true. And I think that the this is the thing about the parents. I actually really feel for the parents in this situation, especially the dad. Is George the father's name?
Oh, George. Right? Yes.
You know, he gets accused of sexually abusing her during the trial, which is, I mean, I'm going to just because I know what a liar she is. And I believe everyone when they say they were sexually abused. But like, I'm going to go out on a limb and say there's an excellent chance that that's not true, given the pattern that we have seen from
Very diplomatically
Casey.
Put.
And so she is willing. I mean, let's just assume for like, you know, let's just assume it's not true. She is willing to ruin her father's life because that is like a life ruining accusation. You know, if it's whether it's true or not true, it's a life ruining accusation.
And she's
like,
willing to do it along a couple of axes as well.
Oh, totally. Totally. And she's also willing to imply that her father like drowned her daughter or whatever. Anyway.
Yeah.
So these parents, like he was a cop and she also had she's a social worker or something. Well, she had a super respectable job. Nurse. Nurse?
I think she was a nurse.
Think about like they have two kids. One of them is just not just a disappointment, but like an epic disappointment.
Yeah.
Like an embarrassing
visible from space disappointment.
Like we'll never be able to move out of the house, not because, you know, she's not super bright or she's not super capable, because she's just like a master manipulator who like just can never do anything because she is stunted in this weird way. But by all outward appearances seems normal. Like she's able to drive a car. You know, she's able to get jobs. She doesn't keep them. She's able to get them. She's able to be, you know, to train at the gym, obviously. but imagine like the level of embarrassment like that brings with it. I mean, I have two kids and, you know, one of them doesn't do his homework and that's super embarrassing. It's a different scale, but it's super embarrassing. I'm like, oh, he doesn't do, you know, he's wonderful, but he doesn't do his homework. You know, I always say that like in hushed tones. You know what I mean? Now imagine it's Casey Anthony that's your kid, like pre-pregnancy, pre-murder, pre-everything. And you're always just like, oh, yeah, Casey. And she still lives at home.
Yeah.
You know? She has a car. She has a car, but it's really our car. And she has to ask permission to take it. And she doesn't always do that. Like, it's embarrassing. He was a cop. That's got to be embarrassing.
Well, yeah. And on top of that, they point this out in part two, that he left the house with a whole bunch of prescription pill bottles and some booze, got a motel, wrote a 6-page suicide note. It didn't work, this attempt. But they talk about his suicide note, and like, usually, like, if you really are intending for this to work, and they don't seem to think that he was insincere, like, this was not a like cry for help attempt. He was trying to kill himself. And there is nothing in the language of the suicide note. There's no confession. He's just like, I need to be with Kaylee. This is all too much for me.
He loved her. Yeah. Yeah. They were her parents, really. Cindy and George were that little kid's parents.
Yeah.
So they must have been pissed when Casey would leave for weeks at a time and they just wouldn't see her at all. Because, you know, if you look at that room, like, I know the details where details matter. And Laura Richards kind of glosses over this and she's like, clearly she's well cared for. She has a very posh voice, by the way, Laura Richards.
She does. Her hair is a huge problem in this. What are they doing to you, lady?
It's like Rollins' hairdresser from SVU flew to the set to
Yeah, but it's just not like, don't, when they come at you with the moose, tell them you don't do that. It's that simple. Be in your power.
Yeah. And so I really think that for the dad, it was like his baby daughter was dead. I mean, I don't think that's an inappropriate or like uncommonly weird response to that.
And
I mean,
that probably everything that they had been trying to avoid, they failed. Like everything that they had tried to protect this child from, they weren't able to protect her from the fact that her mother is a shit brick. And, you know, sometimes you can't. So, but
I mean, I was going to say, but so that Laura was like, you know, glossing over the details of like the bedroom that she lived in, but like they bought that kid like legit furniture for her bed. She had like an armoire. It just like she had like a crib and a crappy, you know, thrift store dresser that they repainted pink. Like they had, she had like real furniture. She had like, I mean, she lived there. I guess that's the point, is that she wasn't just like staying with them. She lived there. And so, you know, I think that Cindy and George were really the parents, and they, you know, those poor people. I really feel for them. And every time I see George, that shot of George going outside, like punching that photographer.
Yeah. And just like booting all of their little like butterfly chairs off the lawn, that it was like, those chairs are hideous. That's right, George. Oh, wait, that's not your rationale, but you're right, George.
He was right. It seems like a very natural response to me. It always has. It always has. So, yeah.
Well,
really,
speaking of George's note and the forensic linguist.
Oh, God, Fitz.
Fitzy. Okay, well.
Fitz and Jim, man. Those two guys, like, enough. Enough with the profilers who think they are superstar crime solvers who don't actually ever solve anything. Enough with these guys. Like Fitz, the first episode, they're like, he's this expert linguist.
Oh,
and then
let's
hear the Cindy phone call, and he's
let's hear a clip.
She sounds upset.
Let's hear a clip. And then we can maybe dig a little bit into some of our issues with Los Jim. Here's clip five.
Can't wait.
I noticed her descriptors for her daughter. She obviously begins it, I took my daughter, Kaylee Marie Anthony. Okay, that's fine. Putting her full name out there sort of makes sense here. But I counted 8 separate times through this 700-word statement where she used the phrase, my daughter. She almost like has to prove to who's ever going to be reading this that, oh, by the way, this is my daughter. I want to remind you. And of course, if it's my daughter, I would never do anything to harm her.
I've spent every day looking for my daughter. I have lied and stolen from friends and family to do whatever I could to find my daughter.
For the past 4 weeks since Kaylee's disappearance,
I've tried to find any information about Kaylee, whether by going to a popular bar or restaurant.
Popular bars.
Yes.
I mean, that just is so out of place, but I'm still intrigued as to why manufacture so many
untruths? What purpose do they serve for her? And that's the really important part of this.
Well, I don't know if that's the really important part of it. I think the important part is that she's lying through her teeth again.
Right.
Popular bar or restaurant is, I mean, it's sort of darkly hilarious, but
it's hilarious.
But,
I mean,
all right.
Yes,
well,
dark,
what is your current relationship with Real Crime Profile? Are you listening to it?
No, I don't listen to it. But okay. I know of, I've listened to it enough, which was really like one episode once. And then I left listening to a couple episodes that my listeners have alerted me to. Like, okay. Oh my God, you have to hear what a douchebag Jim is to Laura in this episode. So I've listened to those just for that purpose. What's my relationship with them? My relationship is, I know we have some crossover audience, but I don't care enough about that to not say out loud pretty frequently on my show that I think these profilers who've turned into like media consultants and like production superstars with all of these shows, and when they paint themselves as like superhero crime solvers, I think it's total bullshit. And I'm really sick of it. I'm sick of the whole thing. I mean, it does seem like they, in whatever capacity they are brought in to look into or talk about a story, will always take the side of the person who has brought them in to look at or talk about a story. Like, because you can look at that letter from Casey's as a great example. You could see anything you want to see if you read this letter. But the authoritarian way with which Jim and Fitz talk about this language, as if none of us would ever be able to understand the importance, it makes me bananas. It makes me bananas. So, yeah, Jim and I have gotten into it a little bit online. I think that he lately has been, to his credit, listening to the audience a little bit, and he's tried to make some overtures toward acknowledging that he comes off a certain way. And, you know, I appreciate that. Maybe he's becoming more self-aware. I don't know. But these former profiles as experts, like, I'm over it. I'm totally over it. I can't help it. I think the whole thing is just total BS. I really do.
Here's what I don't care for. I listened to Real Crime Profile for a while, and then I began to find that the pacing was too self-regarding and, like, just turgidly full of references to their experience.
Mm-hmm.
And
their heroic experience.
Their
always
heroic experience and the absolutely humorless is not the right word, and monomaniacal is also not the right word, but like the pointedly unwavering, let's say.
That's right.
Focus on reminding you that, like, their hashtags, like, her name was X, which, look, I've said this many times on this podcast. Like, I do this podcast in order to assess the things that I'm talking about as entertainments.
Right.
That's right. The job of the podcast. With that said, I'm not a complete asshole all the time. And I do understand that these are people, they had families, etc. But there was just never any acknowledgement. And, like, I tweeted at them about this a few times and nothing. That, you know, why isn't the victim at the center of this narrative? Well, like, here's the problem with a narrative about a murder.
Right.
The victim exits it at the beginning. That's why the narrative exists.
Right.
I understand that that's not fair. I think
it
is
true.
Important to focus particularly on cases of stalking, on like where, like how long it took to get to this point and where it could have been stopped. I understand all that. But just this, like, you know, in like pauses, you could hear their capes fluttering in the background. And I mean, I am guilty of kind of thinking for a while that Jim Clemente's like swearing and, you know, just sort of going on these rants. And also he has a big nose, and I sort of found that sexy for a while. But okay, first of all, episode 2 of the case of Kaylee Anthony, he shows up in this little hat. It's unacceptable. Killed the lady boner forever. But there also was just this, like, you saw this in the case of JonBenet Ramsey too, that they would do these tests that were not determinative and then be like, well, I suppose we can rule out X based on these tests that did not share enough like baseline controls with anything in reality.
Right. Right. Like, and that's what they do here too.
Yeah. Like Laura climbing in and out of the basement and being like, my butt knocked out that cobweb. So that's right. That. And I'm like, that's
impossible.
What?
Exactly. Yeah. I think that this whole, all right. So I don't know how you feel about sort of like the profiling as profession, hero narrative, like, so Silence of the Lambs basically set us all up for this, right?
Yes. And then Criminal Minds and all the rest.
But which Jim Clemente like has his hands in all of those projects.
Sure. Yeah.
Everything. He's making money off of all of them. And
I'm not sure I remember that. He only reminds you 17 times.
Exactly.
Well, all right. That's Lisa Zambetti's fault. That's on her. Love you, Lisa.
And Fitz, of course, is the guy who was fictionalized in that stupid Unabomber miniseries, right? Played by the guy from Avatar. That was supposed to be Fitz. So these guys
have
their
hands in. That, and I am so relieved. Thank you for confirming that I made the right choice.
That was supposed to be Fitz. And it was the bullshit in that. Like, one of my favorite details of that is that he's married in that. Fitz is married when he starts in a bomber case and like the marriage splits up. And like, there's one other woman in the story who's like, they're kind of hot for each other. And the way the show handles it is like, she makes a play on him and he's just like, no, I can't. And like, no, there's just no way it went that way. It's just him trying to like retell the story in the way that like he told his wife it went down in their divorce proceeding or whatever. Anyway, it's just so transparent and ridiculous. But this whole thing about profiling is so fun in a way for me because profilers love to point to the profile of the person that they kind of put together after an arrest has been made and say, like, see, it's everything I had on this list. Right?
Yeah. And it's like,
but that didn't catch the person. Like, what about all the lists? There's also, by the way, usually a huge pile of profiles. That's completely wrong. But like, so you have your correct profile. How did that profile, how did listing all of those attributes actually help catch the person? Like, it doesn't work that way. It just doesn't work that way. Like, it's people on the ground, like knocking on doors and running down license plates and, you know, doing forensics and all that stuff. Like, that's what actually does it. The profile is just like a tool. It's like one of the things in the toolbox. But if you were to listen to these people talk about their jobs, like, you would think that they were doing everything, that if not for them, like, none of this would have happened.
Yeah, like crime scene technicians wouldn't know what to look for.
Exactly.
And
exactly.
Yeah, like uniform cops would have to be told what suspicious activity might look like. That is a little tiresome.
This is why, what's that series on Netflix, that great series that came out last, with Jonathan Groff, the profile?
Oh, Mindhunter.
Yeah. So this is why I actually loved Mindhunter. And because Mindhunter, and I don't know if that's where they're, if they did this on purpose or if that's where they're going with this, but it's showing the birth of the behavioral analysis unit, and it's showing that they legit just made it up as they went along. That they're like, you know, oh, well, we can't hire a black agent because we're only profiling white serial killers because serial killers typically only are white. It's like, no, you only think that because you're only interviewing white ones. And it shows that like the science was rusty. It shows that they were just sort of like throwing spaghetti at a wall and really making it up. And I, like I said, I don't know if that's where they're going. But one of the reasons I love the show is because I felt like it confirmed a lot of my strongly held beliefs about profiling, which is that it's mostly just total BS. Like, profiles sound like something like this. The perpetrator of this crime was once a baby and then became a toddler. And today is most likely a man. I mean, that's how they come to sound, right? They just don't sound real.
Well, and it's also so broad that it's like, 25 to 35, you know.
Always.
Like, oh, could be 40, though. Oh, all right. Between 5'5" and 6", like, they never cut off anyone that it's like, okay, so this murderer is not Kareem Abdul-Jabbar.
Right.
Cool. or like, fuck, gotta cross Kareem off. Like, guys, come on.
Yep. So that's where I am.
And Mindhunter, that guy is based on, like, I quote John Douglas all the time. I love the cases that haunt us because his co-author is a really good writer, especially in this genre. But oh my God, like, if you think that gyms are massive blowhards, they learned it standing downwind from John Douglas. Oh my God. He's so full of himself. He's going to pop any second.
Yep. Yep.
Robert Ressler's not so bad, though.
We should do a profile of profilers because I think we're coming up with a type here.
Okay. Not Kareem. Got it. We're babies.
50 and up. White.
Still are male. Kind of babies.
Get into Twitter fights with people with 6 followers who don't agree with the way that they talk on podcasts. It's a lot there. It's a lot to unpack.
May or may not be from Philadelphia. I sort of got lulled into, like, I didn't need to leave that last clip that long, but I was just like, I just kept listening back to it, like, yep, he's from Philadelphia.
Who, Fitz?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that comes up in the stupid Unabomber movie. He talks about solving it because of the way people in Philadelphia say water.
Oh.
It's like a big part of it. It's a
big
part
of his linguistic genius. Hurry up, go give me water ice. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I was, like, raised amongst Philadelphians. I can spot it a mile away. All right. Do you want to get back to the chloroform? Yes.
Let's do it.
Okay.
So is there a clip or can I just tell you what I think?
Why don't we, I mean, you can always tell me what you think, but let's hear the clip and then let's see if you can wrench whatever you're going to say around to do with the clip.
Perfect.
The prosecution believed that Casey Anthony used chloroform to kill Kaylee. Chloroform was once used as an anesthetic, but it's no longer used for that. It's hard to acquire, and contrary to what we've seen in the media, it's not commonly encountered in crime investigations.
Reports surfaced this week that the potentially deadly chemical chloroform was reportedly found in the trunk of her car. A drug that can cause a person to pass out and can be fatal at high doses.
We later discovered that there were chloroform searches on the Anthony computer.
It's one of those critical points early on that made suggestion that it was more than just simply an abduction.
Hmm.
Except maybe it didn't, because first of all, their conclusion is like, well, it's really hard to make your own. Therefore, she didn't because she's a dumb. Like, right. All right, that's not really a profile.
It's also not acknowledging, first of all, their tests were like the way that they come up with the control for the test is by, this young woman isn't a chemistry student. Let's see if she can follow the directions. Okay.
Yeah. Like, we all had scientific to take high school chemistry. Like, yeah. And then they're all standing around there in goggles like, yep. You know, you don't want to breathe this in. Like, I don't believe anything that's happening here.
Right. So there's one hugely unacknowledged fact that they don't mention and that like people don't seem to talk about when they talk about this chloroform thing. And I don't understand why. You know, when that guy says, despite what they tell us in pop culture, the media, first of all, like since Tom and Jerry, do we have seen anything in the media about chloroform being used to commit crime?
I was going
to
say, where did she get this idea from? Watching Jimmy Cagney movies?
Right.
I don't think
exactly.
So.
Reading Curious George books. when we think about chloroform, when I think about chloroform, I don't think about it as a murder drug. I think about it as a knockout drug. Right?
Yeah.
Chloroform on a rag. Like every 1970s like kidnap scene has chloroform on a rag.
Yes.
So if she's looking up chloroform or if somebody is looking up chloroform on their home computer, nobody looks up chloroform. Maybe some people do. It would never occur to me to look up chloroform unless I was looking it up because it's a knockout drug, not because it's a murder drug. Right?
Right.
So there's this idea that like she wanted to kill her with chloroform. Like, no, she probably just wanted to knock her out with chloroform. Like, that's what it's for. That's what we've been told it's for our entire lives, including in that Curious George book. So there's that. And then also like the science experiment, which they say, well, if she couldn't have made it, then what? It's like, no, maybe she did exactly what this young woman did and she made it and it was like the white crystals in there are the chloroform. But then if you want to use it and have it be effective on animals and people, you need to distill it and like just throw up their hands like, oh, like nobody would be able to do that. But maybe
they don't even try to do that. Like,
yes,
I mean,
but, But maybe she didn't distill it. Maybe she just took the white crystals out of the thing with a slotted spoon and put them in a rag and thought that that would work. And that's why her kid died. Like maybe like she thought she was going to be able to knock her out. She half-assed the recipe and then she used it as it was instead of distilling it or whatever. Like there's a million possibilities. And instead, the one they come to is, well, couldn't have been that. I don't get it. I don't get it at all.
Yeah, like it's too hard for most people to do. Ergo, it wasn't done. Like, once right. again, we're back to how little is actually narrowed down by the profile.
Right. Or maybe it was just done poorly, and that's why the kid died. Maybe that's what happened.
Or maybe she did it exactly right, because this was something that she cared about doing, which was right. instead of actually caring for her toddler when the toddler was acting up, just knocking her the fuck out,
mm-hmm.
seems likely. Mm-hmm. That she didn't account for the dosage for, like, she got through everything except, like, adjusting the dosage for a not quite 3-year-old.
Right.
So she used enough for, you know, a profiler for Kareem. And then she knocked, you know, like, the ultimate knockout. And then they're never going to know because
no.
the body was not found in time to do any meaningful tests for what right. actually happened. So.
Right.
We're never going to know. But on the other hand, we kind of know. And yeah, I mean, I'm going to watch the last part of it because I'm not a quitter, I guess. And I sort of enjoy, like, the camera often cuts away to Jim and Laura just looking like they were not prepared to not get conclusive answers. And they're frantically trying to think of something like, conclusory to say.
I like that they have to do it in their stupid war room. To me, that's funny. Like, let's get everyone together. Let's all sit down together.
Yeah.
And you have the cop who was like the FBI guy who worked on the case wearing his very best dad tie. It's uh-huh. adorable.
Oh.
Then you have the professor dude wearing his bow tie, which is adorable. Fitz goes tieless, which I just think is disrespectful.
Agree. Also
Jim
get
Clemente
a haircut.
He's wearing like a black t-shirt under his dress shirt, which I'm not a fan of that look.
No.
Laura looks like she's, you know, about to go to court. It's lovely. But they have like their thing where they're scotch taping photos up on the wall. They're making phone calls. It's like, guys, the conceit of the war room, like the trappings around this alleged investigation, like the rental car that you see Laura driving around and like, we don't actually need that. Like, this is really this whole thing, this whole brand, the Real Crime Profile brand. It's like basically an extension of what they do on their podcast, but for TV.
Mm-hmm.
And they've come up with all these artificial TV things to make it watchable or palatable. But wouldn't it just be like the same if they just like sat somewhere, like did a two-way with a camera, like every other true crime show in the world?
Yeah. Or just make it a podcast. Like, I mean, I've said many times, like, there are a lot of these true crime, like, magazines or, like, true crime tabs, I guess, mm-hmm. as my husband calls them, like, 48 Hours, Dateline, like, that they would be just fine, only audio.
Right. Absolutely.
Because you're just seeing the same pan and scan of that old family photo with someone looking happy before they got killed 17 yep. times. Do you need that? Not really. Just listen to it. It's fine.
I can actually like prove that that's true because there is, and I guess they're actually making a real podcast that's separate now, which kind of bums me out. But there's a podcast of the PBS show Frontline.
I love it.
It's just audio from the show.
Yeah.
And it's amazing. It's and like it totally
quite a
works,
bit except, less depressing without the
yes.
visuals.
And once in a while, the lady comes in and just like says the title of the person who's talking, like,
yeah,
oh, Secretary of State Madeleine Albright.
And she sounds so very NPR.
But it's great proof that like a television show just can be audio. Like I often think, and I don't understand, for instance, why the production companies who make like General Hospital and Young and the Restless don't put out an audio version of the show that people can just listen to at work on the side, like when they're doing other stuff. Because if the barrier between keeping up on your stories is not being able to sit down and watch it, like you get this exactly the same experience.
Yeah.
To it. Yeah.
And it just reminds me of what you said just reminded me of that montage in Tootsie where that lady is like typing and taking dictation, but she has an earbud in and then a little watchman in her desk drawer and she's watching Dorothy.
Yep.
On the show. So good.
Yep. Yeah, it's really good.
All right. Well, you know what? I'm going to rewatch Tootsie tonight instead of part 3 of this.
Yeah.
Because the outfits are better and I'll be laughing
true.
On purpose.
It's true. And what on what channel is this airing now?
This is on Oxygen, which is
so it's like an NBC product, right? Because CBS doesn't want anything to do with it anymore after the ChatGPT debacle.
I think CBS was like, oh, well, it's, you know, 6 hours of original. And then they're like, just kidding, 4. And then they kind of buried, like, I think the second part they put on at like 7.
Which and then they were named in a lawsuit. So that can't be good, right?
Oh, Burke. Good luck, kid.
Good luck.
Something's got to go right for you, and it wasn't eating pineapple. Spoiler/ don't sue me. We will have a link in the show notes, but this should all be up on the Oxygen website by the time you are listening to this. Once again, it's the case of Kaylee Anthony, and please just let us know what you think on social media. We're at Blotter Presents on both Facebook and Twitter. All right. Well, just when you thought it couldn't get worse, it's our cold case section, which is an
amazing,
even more gruesome crime with even more risible production values.
I loved it.
Well, here's the thing. It was only 21 minutes, so it was hard to be mad at it because at least it got in and out and then it was done. This is something that I had actually never heard of before. Trying to find us a cold case. It's called Confessions of Crime.
Which is a weird name that makes... shouldn't it be Confessions of a Crime?
Well, and that's how I had it in in our rundown doc, but it's Confessions of Crime. And then on Amazon, they misspell both Lifetime, which is where this originally appeared back in the day, and Interrogation, which does not have two A's in it. So that's what you're dealing with. This is season 1, episode 12, Motherhood by Murder. Let me give you the case file. Obsessed with having a baby, Darcy Pierce lied to her husband, family, and friends about her, quote, pregnancy. Then, armed with her background reading on how to perform cesareans, kidnapped the 8 months pregnant Cindy Lynn Ray, drove her into the desert, and cut Cindy Lynn's child out of her to try to make her own due date deadline. This sounds too gory and sad to contemplate watching. Don't worry. Lifetime's vintage Confessions of Crime undercuts the horror with amateurish reenactments and a host whose own story is 10 times more compelling than the show, starting with the massive shoulder pads in her leather jacket that she's doing and that she's wearing in walk arounds. The host is Teresa Saldana, may she rest, also no relation. I had no idea that this had happened to her, that she was attacked and stabbed multiple times by a fan in, I'm going to say 1982, came back from was in surgery for a day in the hospital for months, came back from that to win a Golden Globe for The Commish. She played Chiklis's wife. And then eventually her attacker, who was basically an incel, he went to jail for attacking her, but then was deported to England for a bank robbery that he'd committed 30 years before that, was put into a mental institution, and also died in 2004.
Right. And her stalker inspired Rebecca Schaefer's stalker, right?
Yes.
Ugh. Yes, which is bananas, because Rebecca Schaefer and Teresa Saldana bear some a resemblance to one another. In the giant hair kind of way.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Yep.
Yep. Ravishing
giant
brunettes,
haired brunettes. Uh-huh.
Yep.
Yep. And Teresa Saldana was an activist and founded an organization designed to raise awareness about stalking. And there is, you used to, I think, just be able to call California DMV and get anyone's address. And thanks to her activism, a bill was passed that made that no longer possible, which... about fucking time. Hello. I can't help but feel like the Golden State Killer got some mileage out of that oversight. Mm-hmm. She appeared in a movie based on her own case and I think in a Hunter episode based on her case.
Wow. So she was doing her own reenactments.
Yeah.
Wow.
Which I wish she'd been doing all the reenactments here because oof. Oh,
it's so good. What makes it good, there are two things that make her introing super good. One is, I don't know if it was actually shot out of doors, but the cricket sounds, it looks like it was shot on a soundstage. And then they've mixed in these cricket sounds like super duper loudly, which is really fun. There's her earnest, very, very earnest, almost like, you know, before I realized it was her, I mean, I knew it was like, that woman looks familiar. And then I was like, wait a minute, I think I remember her from being like a TV actress. I was like, was she like some sort of like cop or something? Because she's acting like she used to be a cop. Like she's super earnest, like really staring at the camera. She's got tons of lipstick on. But the music, the way the music is mixed in this whole show, it's like you can barely hear the people talking because it's so loud. And you know that direction that you send out, which is really smart, by the way, and I'm stealing it for future guests on our podcast, where you tell on your Google Doc to turn your headphones down so that like there won't be an echo. There's an echo of her talking all through her own talking. And I'm like,
I didn't even hear that.
This is like some hinky ass production. It really is. It's bad.
Yeah.
It's real bad.
I have some other sound notes later. But here, this story, I mean, talk about like, talk about that sort of sexist narrative. Like, this is that. This is a really tough one. I mean, first of all right, let's hear clip 8 in which you sort of feel like Darcy Pierce, had her attentions been directed in a more positive and productive manner, would have been a really excellent addition to
the
society. Or that. Here's clip 8.
In March of 1986, Darcy told Ray she was pregnant, but it was a lie. And it wasn't the first time she had told him such a story. She needed people to believe she was a mother-to-be. Darcy was very convincing.
She showed us how she had learned to move her rectus muscles, the muscles that go up and down the belly here, to make them move so that it appeared that a baby was moving. It was really impressive.
She never tried to hide her body from the people who were closest to her. She was quite proud of it. I talked to her father, who said he had felt her stomach and felt the child kicking.
I mean, look, I am fascinated by cons of all sorts, and especially the ones that really rely on the social. I mean, they all rely on the social contract. The word, you know, the term is short for confidence, but that's, I just love that these talking heads, the guy there is her attorney.
Yeah.
I think, but the woman is just a, like whatever OBGYN they could get to do this show. And she's like, well, I guess she had examined her at some point. She's like, yeah, it was pretty impressive. Like she showed us how she did that. Like, I mean, it is kind of impressive.
Yeah, totally.
Don't think I understand the intense motivation to do something like that, but sure.
But wasn't it her strong desire to be a mother because she always gets what she wants? Isn't that what it is? You don't buy that?
All right. Let's just hear clip 9 in which some distressingly blamey phrasing is used to not really get into where Darcy's problems probably began.
Right.
At 6 years old, Darcy became sexually active with her 7-year-old cousin. Now, the question becomes, where did that come from? Where did that knowledge come from? Why would she do that? She continued in a relationship, an active sexual relationship, for a number of years with this cousin, and then they finally sort of broke it off.
Darcy began thinking about what it would be like to have a baby of her own. According to Darcy, she would put pillows under her clothing as she played as a very little girl, stuffing herself so that she would look pregnant, pretending that she was pregnant.
Before I start bellowing, would you like to begin the rant?
Sure. First of all, the Casio keyboard loop behind all of those clips is amazing. It's just literally like you push the button for like
very is that the VC Andrews setting? Because
pretty much
stop, guys. Come on.
So at 6 years old, she begins engaging in a sexual relationship with her cousin. That's not what you call it, guys.
No.
When it's children.
No. That's not how we talk about obvious victims who are in the first fucking grade.
That's right. These are, definitely one, because they tell us, and they completely gloss over it, but they do tell us, definitely her and probably also the cousin are victims of abuse. I mean, it's like, it could not be more clear to me with my armchair psychology degree that they're reenacting behaviors that were done to one or both of them, right? That's super obvious, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you break up.
Right.
Because you're still in grade school, and that's not how we talk about these things. And it wasn't back then either. I'm sorry. It just wasn't.
Right. No. It wasn't consent. It wasn't not a consensual, healthy sexual relationship.
Yeah. Began a sexual relationship. Oh, God.
Yeah. It's a weird detail to include, too, as if it has anything to do with. But I guess that's the whole narrative, right? That she, from the beginning, knew how to get what she wanted or something. And so
she was adopted as a very young, as a newborn. And
abused.
Yeah, abused. But then they're talking about how she always had this antagonistic relationship with her adoptive parents and, you know, fantasized as a teen about killing her mother. And I was like, not indicative. I read my journals from that same period. That doesn't prove anything.
Right. It either proves nothing or it shows that she is mentally ill. Like, this is what's really tough, because if you just hear a story like this, I think that it's very easy for viewers in the early 90s of this is like the only true crime, like, culture there is to listen to or watch or
read. Yeah, it's this Unsolved Mysteries and maybe 2020 sometimes. Yeah.
Right. And to fit into that 21-minute package, it goes right to, the Black Widow narrative or the, predatory mother narrative or the, seductress murderer narrative, all these bullshit like tropes around women who must be basically like scarlet letter worthy, because otherwise like they have to be, they're like more off than men who would have committed the same crimes. It's the way they're sort of characterized.
Right.
But I hear this even just a little bit of this story, and I immediately go to like, this is a person with like a severe mental illness, like pretty fucking obviously severely mentally ill.
Yeah. And post-traumatic stress as well. And then here was my other issue with that clip, is that it's then paired. The guy isn't the author of a book, I assume, about this case. Chyron doesn't really say. And then the woman is a forensic psychologist who's talking about play acting behavior that is completely unremarkable as far as I'm concerned. Like stuffing a pillow or a basketball under your clothes, like don't have kids. I did not choose to, I chose not to do that. That was always kind of where it was going. But when I was 9, you like put a basketball under your clothes, because that's what
everyone
did.
Yep. No, so I totally agree with you.
So to
nothing
pair this like obvious dysfunction and mental illness with this like, well, this, thing that literally every girl child probably does, not all, obviously. Don't at me, but like if I did it, everybody did it. So yeah. And then
same.
Yeah. So I don't know. I just there was so much to this story that there were so many opportunities that they had to not sensationalize this, hand that rocks the cradle-y-ness of the story, and they failed to take these opportunities, on top of which.
Speaking of that movie, like what is the time differential between that movie and this episode?
This
how popular
like,
was this narrative like in 1991 of like baby stealing women or obsessive?
I guess pretty. And then there was also there was also, like, at the same time that the crime was actually occurring was, I believe, the Mary Beth Whitehead, the surrogate mother who...
Oh, yes.
So that was like a... I think that was just a thing in the... It was, yes, like on the wire, so to say, in the culture.
Huh.
But yeah, I think this episode was... Was that 91? Well, yeah,
91. Yeah. Yeah, I'm looking at Hannah Rossett Cradle came out in 92.
Right.
So this was definitely like a story we liked at that time. I mean, that's something that we see. Like when we... Even when we talk about old Law and Order episodes on our Law and Order podcast, like it's not the rip from the headlinesiness of it. Very often they'll be like the same kind of story in one season, like even if all six of them are based on real crimes, but there's a kind of story that we tend to like at a specific time.
Yeah.
I'd say like right now we are kind of entering a time where it's like the wrongful conviction narrative is the one we like, mm-hmm. At least among some of us who listen to certain kinds of true crime podcasts. But, you know, and I think in the 90s, I mean, think about like the huge movies that came out that were like, you know, what was that movie with Sarah Michelle Gellar where she was like a temptress who like Ryan Felipe.
Oh, Cruel Intentions. Sure.
Yeah. There was definitely like the sort of like bad girl, evil temptress like thing, you know, movies like Hand That Rocks the Cradle, that, you know, that the threat of the wrongdoing woman is like, you know, where zombies were that in the 1960s, like it was like the evil woman in the 1990s, you know, that seemed to be what we liked. And like the crimes that took place on shows like Melrose Place, for instance, kind of all had that, like the seductress at the heart of it, who just always gets what she wants and, you know, does everyone wrong. And this
or
fits that
this idea,
neatly.
This idea of like this hyper feminized, like this weaponized baby wanting.
Yes.
That's like, I mean, it's very telling about like sort of fears in a culture as well, mm-hmm. that it's like, oh, well, you know, as afraid as we are of, for example, like the archetype of the mother protecting her young, we're even more afraid of, you know, a mother who has not had any young and wants them desperately.
Right.
And then, you know, someone like me, of course, completely disappeared from this narrative, which is like, no, that's fine. That's good. I don't need anybody telling me what I am.
So like, you don't want to have kids. So like, do you ever wonder what would happen to you if you were the commander's wife in The Handmaid's Tale? Like, you're like, oh, I don't want that. And I don't want a handmaid.
Yeah.
Because that's the same. I mean, of course, that book came out like a long time ago, but that is the same, like that fear of like the desperation to procreate sort of being at the center of this whole like construct around which like rape and murder is perpetuated. It's, you know, it's, and I think Margaret Atwood in the book was trying to be more, you know, pointed in her commentary about that. But this is just like the ham-fisted polar opposite of that, where it's like, you know, a woman wants a baby because doesn't every woman like desperately, so desperately? No.
Well, and there is like,
it's not true.
There's an aspect of like, there is sort of sympathy for her position that I think like in society's narrative about this kind of crime, it's trying to put it along the same set of data points as a parent killing the person who molested their kid. And right. It's like, no, that's not like,
it's not the same.
That's straight up vengeance. And like, we all get that. It's right. Not ideal, but we all get that.
Right.
This is probably some kind of dissociative, like delusional post-traumatic event that, I mean, she got like books out of the library to learn how to do cesareans. And then she did one, and this woman died. This is not, you know, there's all this shit wrapped up in it about like, you know, what it means to be a woman and useful to the world, that God knows what Darcy Pierce internalized as a child who was sexually assaulted. So, and here's the extremely classy choice that the sound design made to memorialize Ray's discovery of a pregnancy that was not happening and his audio slow-mo rage.
Oh,
listeners, this isn't your stomach growling. It's the audio of Ray yelling. Clip 10.
Ray eventually discovered that that pregnancy was a complete fiction, and he was angry. Scared that he would leave her, Darcy invented another pregnancy, convincing Ray that this time was different. She really was pregnant. Ray believed her. They got married and moved to Albuquerque, New Mexico. Mm. But again, Darcy's story was a lie.
What? I mean... I think it was my stomach.
Yeah, they paired that with like slow-mo of the actor playing him yelling and pointing, right? So whoever did the final production on this was like, okay, we're going to use this like slow-mo B-roll to show the yelling.
Along with this like weird lens flare doubling to indicate that Darcy is not well. Like, oh, word? She cut a baby out of some lady that was just trying to be nice to her.
Who, by the way, that lady was way nicer than I would have been to like stop and talk to this person, right?
Well, and then get in her car to talk.
Yeah.
It really was a different time. I feel like that was a different time. Definitely the story in the 80s, at least, was like literally every incidence of hitchhiking ended in a murder. Kids, don't
every
do
single
it.
One.
Yeah. all right. Well, our last clip is Darcy. The sound on this is not great. I tried to clean it up, but they just, I think, like held a boom mic up to a cassette recorder to get this interrogation audio. It's pretty chilling. Here's Darcy explaining her thought process as she departed the desert. Clip 11.
I don't remember how the baby came. The baby was just there, so I took it. And I pulled off my dress and wrapped the baby in my dress and put the baby against my chest because my slip was real long to keep the baby warm. And I got in the car and I was driving really fast. And then I started thinking, I can't just show up someplace with this baby in my arms around here.
No, you can't.
And not have some kind of a story.
Oh,
I mean,
now that's dissociation right there.
Yeah.
Like that is what that looks and sounds like to me, to my armchair psychiatrist ears, right?
Same. Yeah. It's both startlingly cold, but also like all the words in that order appear to make sense.
Mm-hmm.
But once again, I'm reminded of that, and I wouldn't say that she's a sociopath and, you know, I'm not qualified to say either way, but it reminds me of that thing in Fatal Vision by that citation of Herv Kleckley's book on sociopathy, where he's like, yeah, it's a, you know, finely tuned reflex machine designed to mimic human behavior. But when you spend enough time with it, you see that it's actually... that it's a, like a crash test dummy with a dress on, like it just doesn't, something is not right.
Right. Right.
And like pretty much everything is not right with Darcy. And this case, I don't know. I mean, the show is, I have seen far more professional bat mitzvah videos, like I said, from the time period.
But the jewelry that our host has on, I think, may have been worn at a bar mitzvah just before this show was filmed.
Yes.
Right?
She may have come straight from the bar mitzvah.
A celebrity appearance at a bar
to
mitzvah.
To the set, and some crickets got in the car with her.
That's right. And that hair. Jesus.
It's,
that Pantene hair. It's
follow unbelievable. Follow us on Twitter, at Blotter Presents. You will be able to see that and many other graphical.
You've never seen bigger hair in your whole life.
In
really.
Wet Hot American Summer at the movie, when Garofalo has it like all combed over her head and moosed up like from the bottom of her neck, like all the way over the side. It's that.
Mm.
It's how we lived, Rebecca.
It is. It's the Kelly LeBrock
Yes.
Don't hate me because I'm beautiful hair situation. I think much bigger, though. I'm giving Teresa Saldana like the big hair prize for this. When she walked on the screen, I was watching it on my like iPhone 7 Plus. So it was only 5 inches wide. And I had to pause and just like with my thumb measure the proportion of hair to head. It's really incredible. It's incredible. Like her hair is, if you just look at the size of the head in total, you realize the hair is like 74% of that circumference. It's really incredible.
Yeah. She leaned in.
Yeah, totally.
Bless her heart. Yes, she died a couple of years ago of complications from pneumonia, which is a little unusual. It's not like she was in her 80s. But I am definitely going to try to track down the movie about her, starring her, and also the Hunter episode. This show's pretty fun. Like I said, it's on Amazon Prime. The production values are
hilarious.
Hilarable, yes. But and
it's like a parody. Doesn't it feel like a parody?
It did, yeah. It's like if it's like American Vandal season 2.
Yes.
Flashback to the turn of the 90s.
Yes.
And it's not like I thought we were going to get any like penetrating commentary on what, you know, the madnesses to which women are driven by societal expectations. But I thought this would pair interestingly, at least, with the case of Kaylee Anthony. And I think I was right, although maybe not for the reasons that I thought. Would you agree?
Yeah, I think you're totally right. I mean, I think that, first of all, how great would it be to see the Kaylee Anthony case done by this 90s show? Like, that would be peak, right?
Yes.
Totally peak. Yeah, and because I think that this is a story where, you know, I would love to think that if some show covered it now, they would do it differently, but they probably wouldn't. I mean, this is like the Investigation Discovery, like, recipe, this whole thing.
Oh, yeah.
And when I was watching it, I was thinking, like, this is like the precursor to like the bad true crime media that exists today.
Yeah,
this
but is at the least they don't drag it out.
Profile. Right.
Like,
yeah,
today it would be 41 minutes and you just be like,
and
oh my God.
They have the husband. They have the husband.
Yeah.
Which is bananas. How crazy is that the husband was on it? Was on this cheesy show talking about his wife's, you know, predilections. And he was the one who kept saying, like, if there was something she wanted, she always got it. Like, you were married to a mentally ill person.
Yeah, which you conveniently kind of checked out of. Like, he was military. So there's a long series to be done, I feel, about how certain mental illnesses amongst military spouses and families are perhaps not addressed because it's like, well, I'm, you know, getting on a troop transport and I can't deal with this. I'm trying not to get killed. So
that's right. That's right. I'm only here for a couple days.
Yeah. Be sweet.
Oh, there goes all your military spouse listeners.
You know,
don't
what?
At me,
I
guys.
I was raised by an army brat and Barb is going to back my play. But you know what? At me, because I feel like enough crazy shit has gone down just at Fort Bragg that,
yeah,
I mean, maybe there's just something in the water, but it's a thing.
It's a
also,
hotbed.
Yeah, if you at me, you can prevent an on mic rant about the creation of a military underclass. Oops.
Oh, this is a whole other show. This could be a whole podcast.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, totally.
Do not get my mother started. Let's get you started on a more fun topic.
Okay.
Where else can listeners find you? I hope.
Oh, where can't they? Wouldn't that be a shorter list?
It might be, but I got time. I hope you packed some Gorp. Take a drink of water.
Well, currently, shows in active production are actually Crime Writers On is my flagship show in which we discuss true crime media a little differently than this show does. It's a little bit more Podunk, New Hampshire stuff mixed in and maybe more ranting. I don't know, only because there's four of us.
Plenty
I also
of cat
do show,
lady stuff, though.
Yes. I also do a very fun show with my husband called These Are Their Stories, the Law and Order podcast, on which we discuss episodes of Law and Order and SVU and Criminal Intent. And a show that is on hiatus currently, but people are still discovering it and say it's fun. I have 8 episodes of a little program called HGTV and Me, in which I talk about everything that is weird and awesome about Chip and Joanna, Property Brothers, House Hunters, all of your favorite HGTV trash. So yeah, those are the best places to find me right now.
All right.
Oh, there's one more.
yes, there is. I'm glad
my friends
you mentioned
at
it.
Slate. My friends at Slate would be very unhappy if I didn't mention that I'm also on a little Slate podcast. It's probably the thing that the most people listen to me on. I'm on a parenting show, if you can believe it. Like anyone would ask me for advice about that, called Mom and Dad Are Fighting, that is produced by Slate.
Yeah, that does seem like the pertinent one. But
a stretch.
I will also add, and I mentioned this in the previous Kaylee episode with Toby, that there is a Law and Order SVU episode about the Kaylee Anthony case,
mm-hmm.
starring Hilary Duff and
amazing,
and the lady from NYPD Blue. It's really good, that yep. part of it. Like Hilary Duff is really good in this role, and then right. it takes this like 87 degree dogleg into being about anti-vaxxing
vaxxers. Yep. It's one of the it's a super bananas episode. It's what yeah. I've. There are so many those to me are the SVUs that I love and think about and remember the most. And they're the ones I love talking about because the MacGuffin being the rip from the headlines case where you're like, oh, I know what's going to happen.
Yeah. And then all of a sudden you're talking about measles and it's like, what the hell?
Yeah.
You guys haven't covered that one, though. Have you?
Not yet. It's on the list. That's definitely on my peak. I sort of have Kevin produces that show and he sort of makes the ultimate choices, but I have my wish list and that's on there. But we just did my other one from my wish list, which was the one with Joan Cusack and
oh
their
my God.
Adopted daughter, who was actually a replica of their previously kidnapped daughter. Oh. Another peak SVU episode. But yeah, the Hilary Duff one, we got to do that one. Maybe you can come on and talk about it.
I would love to. I think you'll have a lot of takers for that one. And as long as I get to talk about Vixie Platinum, we're all good.
All right. We'll put a pin in that one for you.
Oh, Rebecca, thank you so much for coming on the show. Long overdue. God. I hope you will come back and talk to us about, I don't know, the Teresa Saldana Hunter episode. That'd be fun.
I'll come on and talk to you about anything you want me to talk to you about. Anytime. Anything. You made this really easy and fun. And man, an excuse to watch, what was it called?
Confessions of Crime. All about interrogations on Lift to Time. TV.
We don't like prepositions here at this titling company.
No.
We don't like them.
No. No. Why waste time? Come on. we can't get the kerning right on this bar mitzvah video. Oh, dear Lord. All right. Well, I hope you'll be back, if only to judge the Irish names face off amongst previous guests, Kevin Flynn, Dan Patrick Brady, and Mike Dunn. That should be fun.
Absolutely.
Speaking of fun, here's what we've got coming up in future episodes of The Blotter Presents. Next week, Dan Patrick Brady returns, because it's a holiday weekend, and that's who you can get, his spouse, to talk about Dead North on Investigation Discovery. We'll also be talking about Joe Berlinger's Wrong Man, Evidence of Innocence, Godfather and Son, and of course, the Smithsonian Channel's Prohibition miniseries. Got a tip for The Blotter Presents Case Files? Visit our forums at previously.tv or hit me up on social media. That's at Blotter Presents on both Facebook and Twitter. My guest has been Rebecca Lavoie, and you can find her on Twitter at Reb Lavoie. I'm Sarah D. Bunting, and I am on Twitter at Tomato Nation. We'll talk to you next time.
In a production of the Previously.tv podcast network.